All right, so welcome. This is a seminar on advanced Ajax and JavaScript. And what we're going to do today is I'm going to talk about the jQuery library. So one of the things that might just come up as first intuitive question is why do we want to use a JavaScript library? And basically, maybe the reason is sort of obvious from having worked on problem set 8 in particular. Because in problem set 8, a lot of the JavaScript that we had to write was sort of low-level JavaScript. If we wanted to like add some sort of content to a document, we had to go ahead and add our DOM nodes manually. And if we wanted to select multiple elements, for example, and we want to do something with those elements, that would sometimes take a lot of code. We'd have to select all the elements as an array. We'd have to write a loop and then do whatever it is we want to do with all of those elements. And then even more complicated things, like, say, making some text fade out, or these sort of really interesting animations. These things are possible with JavaScript, but if you tried to implement these things manually without the aid of a library, it would take, accordingly, a lot more code, too. So one of the things that's sort of nice is that a lot of people have gone out and created these sort of libraries. So we have jQuery is one of the libraries, and it's the one we're going to be focusing on today. But there are also some other libraries out there. Prototype is one of the more popular examples, too. But basically, what these things allow you to do is to simplify common actions that you typically are going to run into when you write JavaScript code. So tonight, we're basically going to walk through jQuery. And it's a pretty big library. There's a lot of different things it can do. But we're going to look at some of those different functions and just try to give you a sense of what it can do and, in part, empower you to take a look at the documentation and then figure out everything it can do to suit your needs. So first off, straightforward question is, what is jQuery? So we go right to the horse's mouth on this. jQuery is a fast and concise JavaScript library that simplifies HTML document traversing, event handling, animating, and Ajax interactions for rapid web development. jQuery is designed to change the way that you write JavaScript. And this basically sort of says it all, in my opinion. Basically, if you find yourself writing any decent amount of JavaScript, if you try to write a web application that's dynamic, has these sort of Web 2.0 effects and conventions, then you're going to find yourself needing to traverse an HTML document, deal with event handlers, and maybe even throw in some animations and probably some Ajax interactions, too. And obviously, rapid web development is a good thing. We want to try to get these applications and these features developed as quickly as possible. So even if we try to add things like animating that maybe seem unnecessary to application, they still add some extra polish, and they make things sort of look nice. That's always appealing, too, try to make things more appealing for people to use. So this is one of the main motivations that we have in trying to use a JavaScript library such as jQuery. So next logical question is, where do you get jQuery? So the answer is simply the jQuery website. So you can download jQuery from jQuery.com. There's going to be this big button here, download jQuery. And there are two versions that you can choose from when you go to the site. So just to explain the difference, one version is called the development version, and then there's another version that's minified. And basically the difference here is this. The development version is basically, the source code is basically nice and human readable. The comments are there. There's a lot of white space. The variable names sort of make sense. So this is a good thing to keep in mind when you're developing your web application, when you're developing, debugging, things like that. If you run into a JavaScript error, for example, the errors are going to make more sense. If you're just interested in knowing how jQuery is working under the hood, you're also probably going to want to look at the development version. The minified version is basically what you'll want to use in a production environment once you actually go ahead and deploy your application. Because the difference is that the minified version, as the name implies, is going to be a lot smaller. So it's compressed, the variable names are a lot shorter, there's no extra white space that's unnecessary, no comments, things like that. So if you try to actually look at this, because of all the compression tricks that the jQuery developers use in putting out this minified version, it's not going to make any sense to you at all. But the main benefit here is that the minified version is going to be a lot smaller, so that when users try to connect to your website and they try to access your page and need to download the jQuery library, you'll be using a lot less bandwidth. But functionally, the two are going to be the same. It's just the developer's version is going to be easier for you as a developer to use. So like I said, there's a lot to the jQuery library. So when you're learning any new language or any new API, you definitely want to be able to rely on the documentation. So the jQuery documentation is located at docs.jquery.com. And it basically includes all the sort of important information you need. There's documentation on the API, all the functions and methods that you have access to. There's some tutorials that are also there, some code examples, let you sort of see how different functions work, little snippets of code just to try to test them out and see what different functions actually do in practice in a browser. Another thing you might also find are plugins. jQuery has a lot to it, but there's even more to it when you look at the plugins that are available. So if there's something that you find jQuery just doesn't seem to be able to do, odds are there might just be a plugin that you can download, and it'll achieve the functionality you're looking for. One word of caution is that in some places, the documentation is pretty helpful, but in other places, it's a little bit on the sparse side, at least in my opinion. So it may be that the documentation on the jQuery site doesn't really help you that much in trying to figure out what it is that's going wrong or what it is, how to accomplish something you want to do. So really a simple Google search is probably your best bet there. There's also a neat website just for general programming questions called stackoverflow.com. They have some questions tagged about jQuery that you can always search there, and it may just happen that someone else has encountered the same issue you're having or has solved the same problem that you're trying to solve. So that might come in handy down the road. So now that you've got jQuery, how do you go about using it? So the first thing you have to do is obviously put the jQuery library up on the web somewhere. So you need to make it web accessible so that users, when they try to access your page, can actually go ahead and download your code. So once you've done that, when it comes to including the code, the library in your HTML, it's just a matter of including a script tag. This is just like you'd include any other JavaScript file in your HTML code. You just use the script tag, include it within your head of the document, and just make sure that the file name you have, jQuery.js here, just make sure that actually points to wherever you've put the jQuery library in on your website. So the next thing you have to do is you want to include this little bit of code in your actual JavaScript. And this is sort of our first little taste of jQuery. So I'm just going to try to walk you through it kind of quickly. Basically, this code is going to trigger an anonymous function that we have right here. We've called it a Lambda function in class. We have this sort of anonymous function here. And this function is going to run basically when the document is ready for DOM manipulation, basically. This is sort of like if you have like an onload handler in your page, like a body onload, except the body onload sort of waits for the entire page to load. So it's going to wait for images to load. If you have advertisements, those are going to have to load before the JavaScript runs. And most of the time, we don't really want our JavaScript to run until really the document object model is ready. And this basically happens before images and everything load. So what jQuery is going to let us do is run whatever code we put within this anonymous function here, and it'll run once the document is actually ready to be manipulated. One other thing you can note is that you can still declare functions in other places. Just because you have this snippet of code that runs once the page is actually ready to be modified, you can still declare functions outside of there and call them from within your anonymous function. So there's really no need to put literally every line of code you have that relies on jQuery within here. It's really just the bare basics. What do you want to do when the page is actually ready to be manipulated? And a lot of this is going to be setting event handlers or doing something when the page first loads. A lot of your code in practice, once you get to writing functions and things like that, is still going to be outside of here. So don't be misled by thinking you have to put all your code within this function. So now let's look at some of the basic jQuery syntax. The single most important function in jQuery is right here. It's the dollar sign function. So you may not think that dollar sign is really a function. As it turns out, the dollar sign in jQuery is just a shortcut to this other function that's actually called jQuery. But it turns out you're going to be calling this function a lot, so it's really helpful to have the shortcut here. So basically, this function does a number of things, but probably the most important, the most common thing you'll have it do is use it to select elements within your document. So what we have here is sort of the basic syntax for going about that. We have the dollar sign, and then we're just passing as an argument this thing called the selector. And we've seen selectors in the context of CSS. We'll look at them in a bit more depth in a minute. And then simply, we have this little dot here, which should be familiar just from talking about objects within JavaScript in pset8. And then we just go ahead and run whatever function it is we want to run. on basically whatever we've selected in our selector. So if we look at selectors, like I said, we've seen these selectors before in CSS, so a lot of them should seem pretty familiar to you. If we want to select, for example, all of the elements within our document that have a given tag name, for example, all of our links, we just want to say, write the tag name. So that's the first example up on top. We just have a tag name. So for example, if we want to select all the links in our page, we just have to select, you know, A. And A would be our selector in this case. We can also specify typically just one element that has a specific ID. So we just use the pound and then actual ID that we want to select. We can also use dot and a class name to select all of the elements that belong to a given class. Then there's some other additional sort of functions. We have this ability to create, to select all of our buttons, for example. With this selector here, we can select all of our submit button, our submit input types. We can select all radio buttons and checkboxes that are select, for example, or checked off. And then we also have the ability to select, for example, any elements that are currently animating. So these are all pretty helpful. Obviously, animated doesn't exist as part of something you can do in CSS. There are a few different sort of changes, that things that you can do in jQuery with selectors that you can't just naturally do in CSS. And another thing we can do, this can come in handy too, is we have the ability to take look at elements in our document and then compare some attribute and then see what its value is. So if we're looking through a form, for example, and we want to know, we want to select the input field whose name is some certain value, we can use a selector sort of along these lines here. We just have the name of the attribute and then whatever the value of the attribute is. And we'll match whatever elements in the document or in your current selection match that selection. And just like CSS, we can also combine different criteria together. So in this bottom example here, we're just going to select the form with ID myForm. That's what this part does. And then within that form, we're going to select all of the enabled input types of type submit, so the submit buttons that are enabled, not disabled. We'll see the difference in a bit if you're not familiar. And then this just verifies that we're going to select input elements. More information on selectors is available, of course, in the documentation online. So there's this other really neat feature to jQuery, and it's called chainability. So one of the really neat things we can do is, say we have some selection. We've taken a selector and we've selected some elements in our document, and we want to, say, do multiple things with this. So in this example, we have we're selecting some elements based on whatever selector is, and then we want these elements to fade out, and then we want them to slide up. So just looking at this section of the code right here, this seems to kind of make sense based on the first example we saw, where we're going to select some code, and then we're just going to run the fade out function on whatever elements we matched. So in this case, if we had selector was A, for example, just running the code we have underlined up there is going to select all of the links, the A tags, in our code, and it's going to make it fade. It's going to make all of them fade out. So one of the other neat things we can do, though, is we can kind of stack functions together or chain them together, which is what we're doing with this dot slide up. So this is what I was talking about when I mentioned chainability. Because what actually happens, we know that when we select, when we run a dollar sign and then selector, what's going to happen is we're going to be returned a jQuery object. And that's just the object that we work with when we deal with jQuery functions. So within that object, there exists this method called fade out. So we run that, and that's why fade out just intuitively works. But what fade out is going to do, it's going to return the same object that we passed to it. So this selector, this jQuery object that we got when we use our selector, is going to be the same object that fade out is going to return. So that when we add on dot slide up and we chain the slide up function onto the code we already have up there, it'll do what we want it to do. It'll make this whatever we've selected here fade out and then slide up. So there are other methods that don't actually follow these rules exactly. So most jQuery methods do, in fact, return whatever it is that they were acting on, some don't, and this is really by design. So say you want to modify this actual selection you currently have. We have things like add and find. Add will basically let you, as you'd think, add on to your current selection, append new elements to your selection. Whereas find, you'll give find some sort of selector as its argument. And then find will basically look within the children of your current selection, and it'll just find whatever elements with among those elements match whatever selector you've given find. Then we also have children and parent. Those are pretty self-explanatory. They'll select the immediate children of your current selection. Parent will select the parent of the elements of each parent of the elements of your selection. And then there's also this method here called end. And what end lets you do, is basically undo whatever the last modification you made to your selection was. So if you run, if you have some selection and then you run like add on it, you can run end after that, and you'll go back to the selection you had before you ran add, for example. More information on different methods available is also online in the jQuery docs. Before I go on, any questions at all on selectors, chainability, traversing? OK. So the jQuery function does more than just select things. We can also pass it a string. And basically, what we want to do is we want to pass a string of raw HTML to the jQuery function. What this is going to let us do is actually create a DOM element on the fly. So we're going to create, basically, in this example right here, we've given it a string. It's just a simple, totally empty div tag. And what this code example here is going to do, it's going to first create our div. It's going to create our div element within the page, and then we go ahead and we add the class dynamic to that, and then we use the text function to basically change. This is sort of like inner HTML. If you selected, you know, dot inner HTML of some element and set it equal to something else, that's sort of what the text function does here. The only thing is that text will kind of sanitize it. So if you pass it, say, like an ampersand, remember ampersands are special, have special meaning in HTML. So text will take care of that issue, for example. It'll make sure that if you pass it an ampersand, it actually displays an ampersand. It'll escape it, basically. And then the next thing we do after we set the text of this div element, we run this function called append2. And what this function lets us do is basically we take the element that we have selected here in this case, the div tag, and we actually put it into our page. So by default, if you create a DOM element using this method here, you're not actually going to see it show up on your page anywhere because it's got to be inserted somewhere into the document first. So all we do here is we simply append the element we've created to the body tag. So all this is going to do is going to take the div you've created and it's going to put it at the end of the page. It's going to append it to what's ever in the body tag to begin with. So another thing jQuery makes it really easy to do is to hide and show elements. So there are methods in jQuery that let us hide and show things. They're just called hide and show. And they really just do that. It's basically like taking the CSS display property of an element and just setting it to none. So that's if you use like hide, for example, in the first example with no arguments, that's what it'll do. It'll just take whatever any element of class hide us and just kind of hide them immediately. These functions also support an argument that lets you sort of animate. So if you specify a duration to hide or show, this should probably be hide me instead of show me, but you could replace this with either hide or show. But basically what this is going to do, counterintuitively I guess in this case, it'll select the element called the element with ID show me, and it'll hide it slowly. Obviously this is a typo on my part. But so basically, it's just going to create some sort of animation. It'll run the animation slowly, and the element will be hidden. Similarly, we can use functions like fade out and slide down. Fade out does what basically it says. It just takes an element, and it fades it out by adjusting the opacity of the element. And then slide down basically just takes some sort of element or multiple elements and just sort of adjusts the height. So it starts out, you can think of it sort of as being like a zero height element. And then we just sort of grow the height for the camera. So we have like a zero height element, and then we just kind of grow it down. So you can imagine it kind of sliding down to whatever its ultimate height should be. So that's the effect we get there. Finally, we have this animate function. There's more than just what we have on this slide, but there's this function called animate. And what this lets us do is basically set up custom animations. So we can change things like text size, we can change border size, things like that. Pretty much anything you think you can intuitively animate, you can animate with jQuery. And if you can't animate it with jQuery, just the actual jQuery library itself, there's a plugin probably that lets you animate it. So color, for example, you can't actually animate with jQuery, but there's a plugin that lets you sort of animate color. So if you want to take red and you want to make it fade into blue, for example, you can do that with a jQuery plugin. So again, more information is in the documentation. So another thing we've looked at in JavaScript, the sort of the old way we've been doing it, is binding events. So what you've probably been familiar with doing in pset 8, especially, is taking an element and then setting some attribute like onClick or onSubmit, for example, with a form. And basically what this does is it binds some bit of JavaScript code. So here we have this function do something. And what this is going to do in this first example here, it's going to take, it's going to listen basically for the user to click on the button, my button, which we said the ID is up here. And once the button's been clicked, we're going to run the function do something. So this is just a bit of JavaScript code that we have here. So whatever JavaScript code we put there is just going to run once we click this button. So we can do something similar with jQuery without even actually touching any HTML. So we've kind of seen ways to bind functions in JavaScript, bind functions to elements in JavaScript. This was something else that the Google Maps API let us do. But with jQuery, it's pretty straightforward. Just apply this to any element. So here, we're going to achieve the same exact effect as we do in the first example. It's a little bit different. We're going to be selecting the my button, the element with ID my button in our document, and then we have this function click, and we give it an argument to do something. Click basically just, when we give it an argument, takes a callback function. So this is like any other function we've seen that takes a callback function, like the handler for XML HTTP request object. We're just giving it here a function name, no arguments, none of that, and this will be the function that we execute when this button's been clicked. So not necessarily impressive in this case. It might be kind of cleaner because we've got now the JavaScript event handler in the JavaScript as opposed to in the HTML, but it may not convince you right away that it's necessarily better or preferable. So one sort of example that we can look at is an example where we, say, select multiple attributes, multiple elements at once. So for example, all of the buttons in some code. And we then create an anonymous function here that basically just takes whatever element we've that's triggered the event, and that's what the special keyword this means. So we pass this keyword this into the jQuery function, and then we use this attr, this attribute function, this method within the jQuery object to set the disabled attribute to be true. And this basically just means we're adding the word disabled sort of within the element if you're thinking of just writing HTML. And then we change the value of the form element to just say disabled. So this is a really simple bit of JavaScript, really simple bit of HTML or jQuery code. So if we take a look at button.html. This is basically, we've just got a series. Let me load this here. All we've got in our XHTML, we've just got a series of buttons. They're right here, separated by line breaks. And we see there's nothing really interesting about these. We've just got generic type equals button, value equals click me. And then we've got the same jQuery up here, JavaScript code. You don't have to worry about the code that's up top. That just makes it so we can refresh the page without screwing up the demo. But otherwise, it's basically what we'd expect. We've got all this code here contained within our ready function. So now if we actually try to click one of these buttons, we'll notice that it becomes disabled and the value changes. So I can click any one of these, and they all become disabled. And if I refresh, we can just do this again. We can do this all day if we wanted to. Just in case you were curious, the reason that we had that little bit of code, I can load it again. the reason we have this little bit of code here is just because if we didn't have this code, for example, when I just refresh the page, this doesn't really matter necessarily much outside the demo. But if someone refreshes your page and if you've disabled like a button with JavaScript, you can't rely on the browser to re-enable it automatically, just because it's enabled when you first load the page. So that's why we have that little bit of code there that just makes sure that all the buttons in the page are now enabled. That's what we do by setting the disabled attribute to false. So once again, jQuery documentation has more information should you be interested. All right. So one of the big things that people are doing nowadays, as we've sort of talked about, is we're using AJAX more and more to simplify interaction with web pages, prevents us from having to reload an entire web page whenever we just want to exchange a little bit of content, just update a little bit of information. So it saves us the need of reloading an entire web page and all the content that comes with it every time we just want to change something. So jQuery gives us a number of functions that sort of simplify the process of sending a request to a page. And two of them are the get and the post functions. So both these functions basically work the same way. The arguments are the same to both. The difference, as you might expect, is just that the get function will send its request via get. The post function sends its request via post. So the arguments basically are just this. We have the first argument is required. It's the URL. It's just the URL that we want to access. This will probably be some PHP script, presumably, that's going to handle some sort of input via either get or post. And possibly, or not necessarily, return some sort of data so that we can respond to whatever the server did. The second argument is this thing called data. And basically, just whatever it is that we want to send to our script on the server side. So what we've been doing for the most part, like in pset 8, is we've just been building URLs manually. So we've had some sort of URL, we've had a question mark, and then some key equals value. And then if we wanted to add something else, we'd have an ampersand, and then we'd have key 2 equals value 2, for example. So we can let jQuery take care of this if we want. So if we said we wanted to send a get request, for example, we could just populate this data argument with key value pairs, or we can also just write the query string that we're used to. But if we pass that as our data argument, jQuery will take care basically of adding this to our URL if we're sending a get request. And if we're sending a post request, then we really need to use the data argument so that we can actually submit whatever it is we want to tell the server via post. So the third argument is just a callback function. And this is basically like the handler that we've been looking at when we've been dealing with XML HTTP request objects. This function is a little bit different, though, because it only is going to be run on a successful completion of your request. So we're going to be waiting for the server to respond, and it's got to give us a valid response. It's got to give us an OK response. It can't give us a 404. It can't give us a forbidden error or anything like that. Or else the callback function is never going to run. So the function that you actually supply as a callback function is going to be given two parameters, two arguments, by jQuery. So the first argument is just data, and data is sort of what it sounds like. It's whatever data the server responds, whatever data the server responds with. And then we're going to have this other argument, text status. This is just going to be success because we're only ever going to see, we're only ever going to have the callback function called when the request was successful. So one thing to note is that get and post don't actually support error callbacks. So if something goes wrong and you really need to catch that with your script, you're not going to be able to use these two functions. You'll have to use other functions. The good news is that it's not much harder to do that. But if you're not worried about errors or handling them, these are convenient functions to use. So there's one more argument that these functions take. It's called type. And basically, all you have to specify here is just what type of data you want to take from the server. So you can take XML data. That's what we've been dealing with for the most part in PSET 8. You can take HTML, plain text. You can get JavaScript, which you can have jQuery sort of execute for you. And you can also get JSON, which is another data format. It's a concise data format. We'll be talking about it in a little bit. But it's an alternative to XML. Just for sending data back and forth between server and client. So if you do need more flexibility than what you get with get and post, there's this other function here called Ajax. I'm not going to get into the details too much. You can read about it in the documentation. Basically, Ajax is sort of the low-level implementation of Ajax within the jQuery library. So if you use Ajax, you can set an error callback, for example. You can set a username and password to use if you have like HTTP authentication that you need to deal with on the other side. And there are other callbacks and other features that you have when you use the Ajax function as opposed to just get or post. And there are more functions besides these, some that simplify the process even more than get and post do. If you want to just, say, load HTML into your document somewhere, or if you want to execute some script, there are functions that basically will even simplify the process more so than get and post do. But if you'd like more information about the, any of that, the documentation will clarify. So I mentioned that jQuery is capable of handling several different types of data when it deals with an AJAX request. And one of those types is JSON. You might have seen this a little bit in lecture or from one of Cato's walkthroughs. But what JSON is, it just stands for JavaScript Object Notation. And what it is, it's a concise data interchange format. It's basically a simple format that we can use to send data from one place to another. It's supported by several different languages, even though it's a subset of JavaScript. If you're interested, the website for JSON is json.org. So one of the advantages that JSON has is that it's much more concise than XML. So you remember that whenever we have XML data, we have to have an opening tag, and then whenever we have something within the tag, we have to go ahead and close the same tag. So what we're doing is we're having the name of the tag printed once in the opening, and we have to say the same tag name in the closing tag. So this gets kind of verbose, and it's not really ideal for a situation where we're trying to minimize the amount of data we have to send back and forth, as we might be worried about if we have like a web server and we want to try to minimize the amount of bandwidth we're spending. So XML isn't always ideal. JSON, at the same time, will save you a lot of the space. So you can look at some examples, just sort of the structure of JSON. Just to walk through some of the examples of sort of data types that JSON supports, we have this value type, which we're just going to look at briefly. And we see that we've got four different types that can qualify as a value. We've got strings, we've got numbers, objects, and arrays. Excuse me. So these are all sort of other types within JSON that qualify as a quote-unquote value. And then we have sort of these literal values here, true, false, and null. So these are just other values that when we have some sort of bit of JSON code, we can use. This is sort of the representation of a string in JSON. Basically, it's sort of what you'd expect a string to be. We start with double quotes, and we end with double quotes. So those occur at the beginning and the end of any string. And then just within the string, we have either basically any character, which is what we have right here, or we might have some escape sequence. And that's basically what the rest of this code just says. We've got some escape sequences, which are just literally laid out here. And these are the escape sequences that we can use within a string in JSON. So this is a little more interesting, an object. And the object is probably going to be something you'll be seeing somewhat frequently if you're dealing with JSON in the context of AJAX. So all an object is basically, you can think of a series of ordered pairs, key and value. So it starts out with the curly brace at the beginning, ends with a closing curly brace. You see the diagram here. And if we look at the example we have on top, we see the same thing. We've got the opening and closing curly braces. And within within these, we have, as our key value, we just have a string. So here in this example, we have literally the string key. We've got the double quotes, which we know a string has to have. Then we separate these things with a colon. And then we have our value. In this case, value here is also a string. That's just the decision we made. We've seen that value can be a number of different things. It can be a number, a string, an array, an object. In this case, we've just made it a string. And then if we have more than one object, we want to separate the key value pairs with a comma. So that's basically what this means here in the diagram. We just have a comma separating the two. And then our next key value pair is right here. We've got key 2, which is a string, And then we've got value 2, which also just, it could be any value, but in this case, we've also decided to make it a string. So as it turns out, JSON is really friendly with a lot of different languages, PHP in particular. So if we want to create, for example, some sort of JSON output, we really just needed a small bit of PHP to accomplish this. So this little bit of PHP code is really straightforward. We just have this variable data, which is an array. And this looks kind of familiar. We've got, it looks like, two elements within the array. One of them has a key, key. The other has key, key 2. And then it looks like the first element has value, value. The second has value, value 2. So we can use this function called JSONEncode and pass to it this array. And whenever we echo this out, what we're going to see is actually the same bit of code, the same bit of JSON that we saw in the previous slide. So this is just the JSON representation of this array with these values. So we can achieve a similar effect using objects as well. So as you might be aware, PHP supports this notion of objects. So here, just to walk you through, in case you're sort of unfamiliar, here we've defined this class that we're going to call data. And basically, all this thing has, it has two elements, two members. We've got a variable called key, and it's probably looking familiar. We've got a variable called key2. So this basically just defines the structure. This is almost like saying we have a struct in C, and the struct has two different variables, one called key and one called key2. So below this, we've created an instance of this object. So we've got the new keyword, and then we've got the name of our class, followed by these empty parentheses. So this is just going to create an actual object of this data type that we've just defined. Then what these next two lines just do, the syntax might look familiar also from C, when you're talking about accessing members of a struct through a pointer. You've got the same arrow notation here. So all I'm doing is I'm taking the object data and just accessing key and key 2 and setting the values to value and value 2. So as you might expect, based on the last example we had, if I try to echo or just print out the return value of JSON encode with this data object, we're still going to get the same output that we had in the last example. So we're just going to have the same key value, key 2, value 2, as we did before. So any questions so far? JSON, AJAX, any of the other jQuery methods we've looked at? Yeah?
Can you also echo anything that's not like a class?
Right. So you can echo basically anything. Sort of, you can pass it to JSON encode. And basically what it's going to do is going to encode that data based on sort of the different values that JSON sort of supports. So we can actually look at... Yeah, that's what we did in the first example. So the question was, basically, can we take anything, can we echo anything using JSON encode and have it output? Right, and the answer is, basically, yeah, we can. And what PHP is going to do, it's going to take that information and it's going to basically transpose it into some JSON representation that makes the most sense. So here we have this data object, and we actually we output that data object in JSON. In this example here, we just have the same sort of, we get the same output, but instead of being an object, we just have an array. So it turns out when we have an array with associative array where we have like a string as a key and then different values that go with each key, the output is really going to be the form of a JSON object. And if you look at json.org, it just kind of, over to the side, it kind of gives you an idea of what all of these different things sort of look like. So we see objects, members, basically different sort of types that exist within JSON. So any valid JSON is going to sort of follow these formats. And here, if you're just interested, we've got object in the array, the value diagram we had before, strings and numbers and so on and so forth. Down here, you just see that basically implementations to sort of output JSON exist in a bunch of different languages, which is one of the reasons that it's becoming a popular data interchange format. that sort of answer your question? All right. Yeah.
So what's the mod Python extension for JSON output?
So what's the... Right. So the MIME type. The MIME type is the question was, what sort of content type do we want to send when we're outputting JSON? The answer, actually, just to kind of jump ahead. Let's see. We're going to want to use what we have right here. So we're going to send content type application/JSON. I'm not sure if it's actually strictly necessary to use that. It'll probably work if I omitted that line. This is an example we'll look at later. But this is typically the content type you'll want to use just to send JSON. It's the standard format, basically. Okay. So jQuery also gives us a method called getJSON, which basically works exactly like get. I realize you're on the slide. So it basically works exactly like get. Basically, the one difference is that we've gotten rid of this type argument, which is obviously redundant because we've said in the name of the function that we want JSON data. So here's a type, which we're not using in our getJSON function. But the first three arguments are actually all the same. So we've still got the URL, we've still got the data we want to send to the server, and we've still got the callback function that we want to run. So here's just a little bit of snippet. Here's a little snippet of code that we could run. So what this is going to do, we're going to say we've got some URL already defined. It's some variable in our code. And what jQuery is going to do when we run this function is we're going to send a get request to this URL. And we're going to supply to the server this key poll_ID. And we're just going to say the value is going to be some variable poll_ID. So whatever this variable has been set to is going to be the value that the server gets for the poll ID. And then once we get a response from the server, assuming we get a successful response, we don't get an error or anything like that, then the callback function we're going to run is just called pollDisplay. So this is a pretty straightforward example. Obviously, we haven't defined any of these things quite yet, but we'll look at an example in a little bit that sort of puts this all together. So any last questions on AJAX before we look at an example? OK. So we've got DOM manipulation, we've got events, we've got animations, we've got AJAX. So now I think it's a good time to sort of look at an example and try to put all these things together and see how they work in practice. So as you might have figured out, the example we're going to look at is basically a poll script. So just to give you a demo, we've got a little bit of XHTML here. All we've got is a simple poll. We've got a question on top. We've got five choices in this case. And then we've got two buttons, vote and get new poll. So in the interest of democracy, anyone want to just suggest what I should vote for here? Shout out. Sorry? Hockey? Okay. So I can click hockey and cast a vote. Well, it looks like baseball's winning. But hockey, we've catapulted to third place. Yes? All right. So basically, this is sort of just how the poll script works. We can vote on something. What's going on, you may have noticed the page didn't actually explicitly reload. We didn't load a whole new page. But we sent an AJAX request in the background to get the information about the poll, the results, and things like that. And then you might have noticed we had some fading. We had some scrolling poll bars that kind of incremented as the votes, quote unquote, came in. And then if I want to click this button, get new poll, without reloading again, I've just sort of loaded a new poll. So random poll, I can say, you know, summer maybe I like. Got the results there. Get a new poll. Nah, I don't really vote on this. Favorite Simpson. And so on and so forth. So basically, looks like every time I call get new poll, we just get some sort of random poll from a database. I just got the same poll twice in a row, but it looked like we were getting unique results. So let's try to analyze some of the code that's going on. So we just look at the source code here. So the source code is actually pretty ugly when we look at it like that. Let's look at Firebug. Okay. So this is just the XHTML, even though this is actually a PHP page. But it looks like we've got a form up here. Action is going to be equal to poll.php, which is actually the same page we've got loaded right now. Looks like we're going to submit via post if this form actually submits. Then we've got this div, ID is poll. We've got another div within that, the question. We've got responses. We've got individual response, it looks like. We've got one div for each. Here we've got the radio button. We've got name equals vote. We've got the value. That's probably interesting. We've got this hidden form field down here. We've set, looks like the poll ID, this is poll ID 1. And then down here we've got, looks like, a couple buttons, it looks like. We've got, okay, cast vote. Looks like it's a submit button, it just casts the vote. And same thing with new poll, this is the button that gets a new poll. Okay, so pretty straightforward so far. But one thing we can do is take a look at the head, where it looks like we're using jQuery, that's a good thing. We've also got this poll.js script. So let's take a look at that. Close it. All right. So we're just going to walk through this script sort of to try to give you an idea of what's going on behind the scenes and figure out why this page actually seems to work. Because one of the things you'll notice is we didn't have any, among other things, we didn't have any events or anything in our HTML code. So we'll just see how jQuery kind of wraps everything together kind of nicely. Okay. So we've got, looks like a couple of variables up here. We've got URL equals pollHandler.php. So this is probably just the script we're using to deal with our AJAX requests. We've got this other thing, var colors equals, looks like an array of just colors we've defined. You might have noticed that we had, when we displayed the results, we had red, green, blue, and orange, just kind of looping like that. So that looks like it might be related to that. And then we've got something familiar looking here. We've got this ready function. And it looks like we're doing basically three things. The first thing we want to do is we want to select the form. And it looks like whenever the form is submitted, we want to return false. So what this is basically going to do is whenever the user tries to submit the form, whenever it tries to load poll.php like we defined in the actual form tag, we're going to end up returning false, basically. And what this is going to do, just like in pset 8, whenever we return false as a result of an onSubmit event, we actually stop the submission from happening like it normally would. So this is good because it prevents the page from reloading, which isn't something we want if we're going to take care of this through an AJAX call. So that's what we have going on over there. Right below that, we've got, looks like we see the click event that we saw before. So this line is going to take, whenever someone clicks on the cast vote button, looks like we're going to call the poll vote function. And then it looks like we've got a similar sort of thing going on here that goes on with new poll. And we're just going to call poll fetch when that happens. So poll fetch is a pretty straightforward function. All we do here is we take this, and remember this is just going to be the element sort of that called us, and we have this in the dollar sign. We can use jQuery functions. So we're just going to disable the button, and then we're going to change its value. This is sort of like the example we saw before when we disabled all the buttons when we clicked them. So this is going to prevent someone from trying to click the button basically more than once, because if they click the button more than once, we might end up sending more than one AJAX request, and that's not something we want because it might... we might get unexpected behavior, basically. Then it looks like if we're not given a poll ID, this is from our argument up here, if we're not given a poll ID, then it looks like we send one AJAX request, or it looks like we're going to use the same URL we defined above. We're not sending any data, so this is null. And then poll display is going to be the function we want to call once the results come back. Then same thing as below, except here, if we do have a poll ID, then we want to submit it to the server. We have another function called pollDisplay. So pollDisplay, we just said, was going to be the function that handles pollFetch, or the request that pollFetch sends. So pollDisplay, looks like the first thing we want to do is we're going to select the poll element. You remember that we had a div tag that had ID equals poll. So that's all we're just selecting here. We're just assigning this to the variable poll. So basically, the reason this is kind of helpful is that we can refer now to this jQuery object just by the variable name. So we don't have to actually go ahead and select it each time we want to call it. This is just sort of a minor sort of efficiency thing that we can do. So we don't have to worry about actually finding the element every time we want to use it. We just refer to the variable. The variable will just remember what we selected last time. So now we've got poll.fadeout. It looks like we're actually giving it a function as an argument. So it turns out fadeout, along with several similar functions, we'll actually accept a callback function, in this case, an anonymous function we're giving it. And basically what's going to happen is this function is going to be run once the animation completes. So normally if we just had poll.fadeout and we had just closing parentheses, we didn't give it any arguments, if we had more code that followed that, what would actually happen is the animation would be running, but our code would be running too, because the animation is asynchronous. So we can't rely on the fact that the fade out might take some number of seconds or anything like that. We really want to have a callback function that whenever the animation's finished, we're going to run whatever code it is that relies on the animation having finished. And in this case, if we're fading out the poll, we probably don't want to actually try to display any new poll information until it's actually faded out. So that's why you have a callback function here. So just kind of run through this code here kind of quickly. We use this function here, this method here, empty, which sort of does what you might think. We had, remember, this div tag that contained div tag ID responses, and it contained other div tags of class response. So we just want to empty those out. Basically just remove them altogether. Here we're going to update the question. Looks like we're using the HTML method to do that. Again, this is kind of like inner HTML, except we don't have any sort of we're not going to try to sanitize the data at all or escape it or anything like that. And then we have this function here, $.each. So this is sort of a utility function that jQuery gives us. It basically is sort of like a for each, as in PHP. So it looks like we're going to loop through data results. And we've got this callback function here. It takes two arguments, the way we're using it anyway. Response ID is just going to be a variable that gets the key of whatever element we're looking at. And response is going to get the value. So it looks like we create a div. So we're creating an element now. We're using that second usage that I showed you of the jQuery function. We're creating a div element. We're just giving it the class response. So this makes sense, because when we looked at the HTML code before, we saw those div tags actually had a class response attached to them for each response that we had in the form. Next thing we want to do is we want to create the input button. So we use a similar sort of technique here. If input type equals radio. And then we're going to set a few attributes at once. So we can do this just by using the same sort of key-value pair notation that we saw before. So we're going to set name is equal to vote. The value is going to be equal to the response ID. So this is something that we're going to be setting as part of each iteration through our loop. So this is presumably something unique. And then we set the ID as response dash response ID. And it looks like we're going to append it to response div. Screen went black for me. Interesting. All right, this will be kind of awkward. So then we append it to response div, and it looks like we defined response div over up here. I really wish I get this to work. Sorry about this. Yeah, I actually just started working, but well, let's pause. All right, yeah. So we'll keep going through our function up here and see what's going on to display our poll information in a little bit. So welcome back. It's been a long time. So we're looking at this function up here. We're just going through our poll display function, which basically just respond. It's a callback function for AJAX request that retrieves basically a new poll from the server. We're just kind of walking through to see how it works. So we've just created our button up here. This is going to be the radio button that actually we use to select whatever poll option we want to vote for. And we've added it to our response div, which we just looked at before. And then the next thing we do is we want to create now this label tag. And if you're not familiar with the label tag, it's really simple. Basically, all it does, you say label, and this it has this attribute for. And basically what I'm doing right here, I'm setting the for attribute to be response dash, and then I'm concatenating that with response ID. And this should look familiar from right up here, where we set the ID attribute of the input button to be response dash, dash then the response ID, concatenated with that. So basically, all the label does is whenever you click the label, it's going to activate the form input field that has the corresponding ID. So this is just a helpful sort of usability thing for users. So they don't have to actually click the radio button. They can click the text that goes with the radio button instead. So then we just set the HTML text of this element to be response.response. So we'll see that in a little bit when we look at the actual JSON data. And then we're going to append this text, this whole this label field, to response div, just like we did the button. And the last thing we do in our loop is that we're going to append this entire response div into this poll. Then within the poll, we find the element with ID responses, which you remember just contained all of our responses. So we just append this as another response. So then it looks like we create another input field. This was that hidden field we had before. Just remember the poll ID that we were looking at. And append, we just make sure it actually gets added. And then it looks like we just update the cast vote and new poll buttons. Make sure that we show the voting button, because remember that disappeared once we were displaying the poll results. So we just want to make sure that it gets shown again. And then it looks like we enable the new poll button, which we had disabled once you clicked the button the first time. Then once it's all done, we just fade the poll in, and that's the end of that function. So poll results is another function. This is actually going to be run to show, as you might think, the results of our poll. So in a lot of ways, it's pretty similar to the function we just looked at, so I'm not going to go through it quite the same way. But just to give you an idea of what's going on, over here we're going to keep track of the total votes and the maximum number of votes. So we just basically loop through the results we get, we tally up the total vote count, and then we just use a simple trick to figure out, once we're done, whichever item it was that got the most number of votes. So then we have a similar sort of loop construct down here. We're going to loop through the results. We're creating a new response div. It's a little bit different in structure because we're actually showing a poll bar to represent the results that we have. It's a little bit complicated maybe at first glance, but it's all the code here is pretty simple. We've got an add class method. We've got a call to attribute HTML, so we're setting the value of some element. Then we're just concatenating some strings together, some different values. So this is just the container we're using to create. We're creating this other tag, which is going to get the class vote bar, and then we're going to give it another class on top of that, which looks like is this expression here. You might remember colors from the beginning of the script, which is an array of colors. Turns out those correspond to classes within our CSS file. So we're going to set the initial width to 0, which is what this method here does. We're going to hide it so it's not visible. And then we're going to append it to the container that we created up here. So this next bit of code basically just determines what percentage of votes this particular option got, and also determine the size of the poll board. Because you might remember that even though in the examples we saw, none of those results had 100% of the votes, but we still extended it to sort of the end of the viewable window that we had. And the reason for that is just because, well, it kind of makes sense, because we've got however much space in the screen. Rather than just say, okay, 50%, something that gets 50% of the votes should go 50% of the way to the end. Well, what if you have a lot of options and you have a close vote? It makes more sense to kind of stretch everything out and make the most of the amount of space that we have in the screen. So that's basically all we're doing here, just some math that just figures out what the width should be in percent, actually, of each box, so that whatever gets the most votes ends up taking up 100% of the screen. So it looks like we just take our result and append that to poll responses like we did before. And then we've got this interesting bit of code here. We're using this function called Q. And Q is going to be in the documentation. It's under the different effects you can run. Basically, all this is going to do, rather than running this animation that we kind of specify here with this animate method, rather than running this right away, we're just going to do as the function says. We're going to kind of queue it up, and we're going to wait to run it later. So whenever we call the function dequeue, which is going to happen, where's dequeue? Down here. This is actually when we're going to run the animation that we're defining up above. So you can take a look at this later if you're interested. Basically, this is just going to make sure that we run that animation we saw. We have the poll bar sort of all the way to the left with no width, and we just have it run up sort of however long until we've stopped at the number of votes that it's gotten. So this is basically all the code here is just taken care of. And we've got this helper function, poll bar set, which is sort of basically round some percentage to the right value. Another trick you might notice is that when we set the duration, we just have this little expression here, which is make sure that each poll bar is going to animate for some amount of time such that it kind of looks like, remember, they were all sort of going the same speed before. What's happening is basically each animation is just a different length, and it turns out that the length that we set each animation to be is such that they're all moving at the same rate, but they stop at different times just depending on how many votes each option gets. So the last thing we do once we're done iterating through that loop, we just hide the cast vote button because they can't cast a vote if we're looking at results, obviously. We just calculate the total number of votes and display that, and then we just make the responses all sort of fade in. And we run, we actually run the animation that we had before after everything's faded in. All right, so poll bar set, which is our helper function. It's not very interesting. And then we have poll vote, which is actually really short. So what this function is going to do, it's going to basically send our AJAX request, and it's going to tell the server basically what it is we voted for. So the first thing we have to do is determine what poll ID we're voting on. And all we have to do is write a selector here that just takes finds the hidden input field that we created before, where the name of the field is poll ID, and we're just going to retrieve the value. That's what the val method does here with no arguments. It's going to return the value of this input element. So the next thing we do is we determine what this person voted for. We have another selector that just finds the checked or basically selected radio button in our field. And basically, if it turns out that they've selected something, then we say, vote equals vote field dot val. This just gets the value of whatever it is they voted for. If they didn't vote for anything, we just say vote is an empty string. Because all we're going to do, we're going to let them submit. We're just going to say view the results and don't cast a vote. So then this line here should look kind of familiar. We're going to send a post request to the URL defined at the top of the file. We've got this key value pair. We've got poll ID and our vote. Our callback function is going to be poll results, and then we're going to expect our response to be in JSON. And the last thing we do is we just disable that voting button so that they can't vote more than once, you know, repeatedly. And that's our JavaScript file. Any questions on the JavaScript?
Okay.
So all these files are available just online. All the files here, all the PHP files have source code equivalents, so you can just look at the source for any of these files. Global is kind of interesting because it defines this pole class. I'm not going to go through it now because it's kind of complicated, more complicated than the examples we saw, and it's not wholly necessary to achieving this kind of effect. But if you're interested just sort of looking more at what PHP can do in terms of object-oriented programming, different concepts there, this is something that might just be of interest to kind of run through. But basically what this is going to be responsible for is dealing with our database and dealing with votes and dealing with retrieving poll information, things along those lines. But I'm going to leave those sort of to you if you're interested in checking them out. So the more interesting thing we're going to see here is this, our poll handler. This is basically the script that takes care of all of our AJAX requests in our JavaScript. So the first thing we do, we include our global, one of the first things we do is we include our global.php file, which I just showed you. We use the request superglobal to try to figure out if this person is specified a given poll ID. So if they want a specific poll ID, rather than just a random poll ID, we try to give them what they want. So here we have poll equals new poll, poll ID. All this is going to do, if you want to look at the content in global.php, this just basically creates a new poll object, which I've defined in that file, and it just tries to fetch whatever poll ID is. So this poll ID, it'll try to load it from the database. Then we have this function I defined, isloaded. And basically, this is just going to return true if we loaded a poll successfully, false otherwise. So if it doesn't load successfully, we just say, OK, load a random poll instead. And this is just a constant that we've defined in another file. And then if this isn't the case, if the poll did load the first time, then we want to see, OK, did the user try to cast a vote? And if so, if the user tried to cast the vote, if it wasn't like an empty string, then we try to cast the vote. And we have this other method, vote, which basically just takes the vote, and if it's a valid vote, updates the database accordingly, and the results get updated. And the last thing we do, we just echo out JSON underscore encode. Then we have this method within poll called getData. And getData is just defined to return an array containing things like the question, the different response options, and the number of votes for each response. And that's the last thing we're going to want to give our JavaScript file. All right, so any questions on the poll example? Okay. So again, there are basically links to most of the files that are important here. If you just like get rid of like the poll.js or the file name, you can just see a listing of all the files in the directory, so you can take a look at any of the source code relevant to the example. So we've talked a bit about in this course about this idea of cross-browser compatibility, right? Where we want to worry about what happens if our user is trying to view our web page in Internet Explorer, but maybe it doesn't work in Internet Explorer, but it works in Firefox. Maybe it works differently in Safari than it does in Chrome or Opera or things like that. So this is just a sort of theme that really all web developers have to worry about, in part because you know a lot of different web browsers don't display pages the same way. And this is sort of true in JavaScript, too, where different browsers might not run the same JavaScript code the same way, might not have the same effect in different browsers. So one of the things that we really want to try to make sure of is that any code that we write, whether it involves JavaScript or not, really, behaves as much as we can, behaves the same way in different browsers, on different devices, different platforms, and under different settings. So one of the things to keep in mind when we're writing more complex web applications, or even simple poll scripts that use AJAX and JavaScript, is that we want to try to achieve as much functionality as possible. And one of the problems we might run into is that a user might, for example, disable JavaScript. Maybe they don't like pop-ups, and they think JavaScript causes a lot of pop-ups, which is true. So they just go ahead and disable JavaScript on any site they don't trust. So that's OK for the user, but what do we do if we have this program that relies on AJAX and JavaScript? Now it doesn't work for them. And we'd really kind of like it to. Another thing might be the browser just may not support JavaScript at all. And it's not really likely that a modern desktop web browser is going to be not support JavaScript. But maybe they're using a phone that doesn't support JavaScript. Or maybe they're using a browser like Lynx. There's this command here, which I'm not going to run right now. But if you wanted to run this command in the cloud, you can actually use the Lynx text-only web browser and actually check out the pull demo. It works, just so you know. Even though Lynx doesn't support any sort of JavaScript at all. But basically, the premise is, even if they're using Lynx or a screen reader or something like that, and they don't have any access to JavaScript or Ajax or things like that, we still really want to try to retain as much functionality as possible. So the way we go about doing this is try to sort of revert back to our old tendencies. So when we were first learning PHP, and we didn't know anything about JavaScript, we just used form submissions, sort of, you know, the web 1.0 way, so to speak, where we just took data from the user and we just manipulated it the way we needed to, and we did it with a full page reload, things like that. And we just relied on the server to do whatever it is the server had to do, and we just basically told the client, we gave it some sort of HTML, and that was it. So one of the things that we end up doing here in our demo, if we actually look at the source code, this is the source code to pull.php, which we looked at before. I'm not going to focus on this too much, but if we look through a lot of the code here, you might notice that some of it kind of looks repetitive with the JavaScript code we wrote. And the reason for this is that basically it addresses the concerns that I just sort of brought up, where what happens if the user doesn't have JavaScript enabled? Then we need to rely on PHP, for example. We need to rely on the user is going to submit the form. Remember, we defined a method, we defined an action. It's going to submit to the same place. So pull.php, in this case, is going to be responsible for actually handling all this information. So we see this code here is basically equivalent to the JavaScript we saw before. It's going to give us the same sort of output when they vote on a poll, and when they try to see results on a poll, or they just request a new poll. But we're not doing any of the dynamic stuff. We don't rely on JavaScript at all. We don't rely on Ajax requests. So it's not as efficient, maybe, as we'd like it to, but it is widely compatible. And it's going to be accessible to people, even if they don't have JavaScript in their browser. So one thing to keep in mind is that if possible and if feasible, it's a good idea to try to do this. Obviously, developer time is always an important resource, and it's not always necessarily worth it to say, okay, we've just implemented this, you know, really slick JavaScript solution, and now we're going to do it all again in PHP. It's not always the most appealing thing to do. And there may be cases where it's legitimately not necessary, or maybe just not feasible, because not using Ajax or not using JavaScript for a given web application might just not make any sense. And there's certainly some cases where that would probably be the case. But if you're trying to develop something that you're trying to make as accessible to as many people as possible, this is definitely a principle worth keeping in mind. Okay. The last thing I wanted to talk about was this, actually another library called jQuery UI. And the URL is up there. It's ui.jquery.com. Basically, it's a separate library that sort of relies on jQuery. It's designed to be used with jQuery. You can go download it online. Basically, when you download jQuery UI, you'll actually be specifying like what features it is you want to include in your downloaded version. So that's just one thing to keep in mind when you go to get it. It's got its own documentation page, a couple places with demos. The first link up there is actually kind of interesting. A lot of the demos are sort of more full-featured, if you will, but they might be also a little bit more intimidating at a glance if you're just trying to learn this stuff. I'm including the second link, even though it's really a development sort of page, and not all the demos work, but those demos that do work are pretty informative and pretty helpful, and they include source code, so it's really easy just to see what's going on. Just to give you an idea what this library can do, there's basically three main features, interactions, widgets, and effects. Interactions are basically just things that let you interact with your program. So, for instance, there's this draggable feature that we can implement. So this is pretty straightforward. We just have the selector here from before. we're just selecting the element of ID drag image. And what this line here just does is it makes this element draggable. We can take our mouse, we can click and drag it wherever we want on the page. And it's really easy to do. It's literally one line of code to do this. And if we want, we can add other effects. So we have this option to change the opacity. So running the second example, whenever we click on this element and we try to drag it around, the opacity is going to change. So it's going to look like it's kind of semi-transparent, fading out, until we let go. And then it'll change back to be opaque. So that's just one example of things you can do with draggable elements. There are a bunch of different options, too, that you can check out in the demo. A corresponding feature is to make things droppable. So what this example does is it selects all of the elements of class drop and just makes them droppable. What this is going to do, it's going to accept any element of class block. So if we try to drag some element on top of this droppable element, we'll only be able to accept it if the element we're trying to drag on top of it is of class block. And if that happens to be the case, we're going to run this callback function. We have dropped an anonymous function. And all that function is going to do, it's just going to write the message dropped onto the droppy, so to speak. So the whatever element is set to drop that we've actually dragged some other element on top of, if the dragged element is of class block, then the drop element is going to get this text dropped written to it. More interactions that you can look up. Basically, you can make things resizable, you can make things selectable, and make elements sortable too. Documentation, of course, has examples of all those things. Widget support is also there in jQuery UI. Basically, widgets are sort of what they sound like. They're widgets, for lack of a better expression. This example is an example of the accordion widget, where basically you can move your mouse or click literally on one of these different elements over here. So we have, kind of hard to see, but we have this thing right here. We have test one, where if we click that or if we mouse over it, it's going to expand. It's going to collapse all the other elements. If I click on test two instead, then we're going to see this expand. And test three, we'll do the same thing. So you can click on any of these or mouse over them, depending on how you set it up. And basically, we'll just see whichever one of these items you select will just expand, and the other items in the accordion just collapse. So this could be a helpful way of just showing data, implementing some sort of menu type interface, maybe. Different options there. There's a demo online, too, that sort of shows you how to set this up. You can also use a dialog in jQuery. It's pretty straightforward to do this. You can set this up with customizable sort of messages. You can also configure dialog to contain buttons, things like that. This is certainly a more customizable approach than just relying on, for example, the alert or confirm functions in JavaScript. So this is something you might also want to check out if you're trying to build like a dynamic web application that kind of acts sort of like a desktop version. This is a simple way to sort of simulate dialog boxes. And there are other widgets too. There's a date picker, which basically, if you need to input a date for some reason, we'll show you like this little mini calendar, and you can select a date based on the graphical interface that gives you, rather than like literally typing out, you know, 11-3-08 or whatever you're trying to type in. There's also a progress bar, which is basically what it sounds like, a slider too, and tabs, which are similar to an accordion, except instead of having that kind of accordion type interface, we've actually got tabs. It's kind of self-explanatory. I think tabs might be a little more full-featured, too. But I should probably just make a note that the demo, when I tried to look at it myself, didn't actually work on the website. But it's probably worth looking into if you're interested, at least in achieving that kind of functionality. So the last thing that jQuery UI includes are a number of effects. And these are sort of effects above and beyond what jQuery itself comes with. jQuery will let you fade and sort of change dimensions and sizes and things like that. These are pretty much just totally unnecessary, superfluous animations. But they're kind of cool at the same time. So you can select some sort of element. You can make it bounce along the screen, almost like the sort of Mac dock icon bouncing. You can highlight elements, give them an animation. You can make elements explode on your page. That's sort of neat, I guess. You can make them fold up or unfold. There's other this other effect called pulsate, which sort of does what it sounds like it does. It just makes it kind of pulsate, changes the color of an element. And then there are even more than what I've got up here. And they're all listed in the documentation online. So this is basically what I wanted to cover. Any questions at all on any of the examples we saw, jQuery UI, just jQuery proper, anything along those lines? Okay. In that case, that basically does it for me. Thanks, guys, for coming out. Good luck with your final projects. Hopefully, if you decide to go with JavaScript or Ajax, you can leverage some of what you've learned here and try to build some really dynamic and interesting web apps. Yeah, sure.
What sort of library does jQuery use to draw those elements or UI elements or image widgets?
What sort of library does jQuery itself... Right. Okay. So the question is basically, how does jQuery, the library, go about creating these sort of effects? And basically, I haven't really examined too much the jQuery code itself, but what it's basically doing is sort of implementing low-level type JavaScript manipulations. So you remember, in JavaScript, we can change like CSS properties of nodes when we select them. So basically, what it's doing, for example, when it tries to like resize an element, say it's trying to scale an element from like the pole bar, for example. Basically, it's just rapidly running a function that just says, okay, set this element to be, you know, 0 pixels wide. And then it runs it again, says maybe set it to be 3 pixels wide. And then it runs it again, make it 6 and 9 and so forth and so on until it's whatever it is it's supposed to be. So that's how it achieves these sort of animation effects. It's not actually relying on images per se. So does that answer? All right. Any other questions? All right, thanks guys.